We turn to chapter 18 of Numbers now, and chapters 18 and 19 really finish up, the account of events in the first year of wandering. Remember that the children of Israel spent about a year and some time at Mount Sinai. They came to Mount Sinai after the Exodus, and then they spent some time at Mount Sinai over a year. And then they traveled. They traveled as far as Kadesh Barnea. That's where they listened to the report of the spies who said they could not take the land, and God judged them for that, told them they'd have to wander for 40 years, 1 year for each day that the spies had spent in the land. Actually, it was not 40 additional years, but 40 years total that they spent. By the time God announced that it'd be 40 years, at least one and a half of those years was behind them, but they did have about 38 more years to go. Chapters 18 and 19 are the only remaining chapters that pertain to that early portion of wandering. At the beginning, I told you that the chapters are not equally distributed among 40 years of activities. We have essentially a block of activities at the beginning of that time, and then at a certain point, and that point is chapter 20, we skip to the end of that 40 years. The assumption is that during the 37 or so years intervening, things weren't much better. That's about probably what we have record of. Is characteristic of the way the Jews behave themselves in the period that we don't have record of. But these final chapters of this section of Numbers do not really have much in the way of story in them, more having to do with ceremonial offering, cleansings, and so forth. Actually, chapter 18 is about how the priests and the Levites are to be supported. It says in verse 1, "Then the Lord said to Aaron, 'You and your sons and your father's house with you shall bear the iniquity of related to the sanctuary, and you and your sons with you shall bear the iniquity associated with it. Also bring with you your brethren of the tribe of Levi, the tribe of your father, and they that they may be joined with you and serve you while you and sons are with you before the tabernacle of witness. They shall attend to your needs and all the needs of the tabernacle, but they shall not come near the articles of the sanctuary and the altar, lest they die. They shall be joined with you to and attend to the needs of the tabernacle of meeting.'" So the priests and the Levites together become the full-time ministers in Israel. The Levites full-time in service, the priests full-time in sacrifice. And when it says, "You shall bear the iniquity," this probably means that the priests would stand as the representatives of the people in dealing with the sins of the people. The sins of the people would be, as it were, imputed to the priests. But it was the ritual of the priest to put his hand on the animal before sacrificing it, which would be then transferring the iniquity to the animal. But the priest was sort of the mediator between the sins of the people and the actual atonement. We know that Jesus is both the antitype, or the fulfillment of these images, of not only the sacrifice, but also the priesthood. Jesus is the high priest, according to the book of Hebrews. By the way, the book of Hebrews is the only book of the Bible that brings that out. That is the unique contribution of the book of Hebrews, is that Jesus is our great high priest after the order of Melchizedek. There are other places in the Bible that tell us that he is a sacrifice. But we can see how the types of the ceremonial system in more than one way depict Christ. In one sense, the priest is a type of Christ. In another, the sacrifice he offers is a type of Christ. Both, however, have one thing in common, and that is that both of them bear the iniquity of the congregation and of all the things associated with the ceremonies, and all the iniquities are imputed to the priests that would appear, and then they bear them and intercede for the people, and of course they transfer them to the sacrifice. The type is not exact, because Jesus as high priest and Jesus as sacrifice plays close roles, but the idea is that the iniquity of persons can be borne by another. And that is what we find said of Jesus in Isaiah chapter 53 and verse 6. Isaiah 53:6 says, "All we, like sheep, have gone astray, and we have turned everyone to his own way, And the Lord laid on him, that is on Jesus, the iniquity of us all. Isaiah 53 says, Jesus bore the iniquity of us. It says similarly in 1 Peter chapter, chapter 2, in verse 24, it says, who himself bore our sins in his own body on the tree. So Jesus bore our sins in himself. God laid on him the iniquity of us all. And Aaron and the priests, in a small way, serve as a foreshadowing of that idea. So look now down to verse 8. And the Lord spoke to Aaron, here I myself have also given you charge of my heave offerings and all the holy gifts of the children of Israel. I have given them as a portion to you and your sons for an ordinance forever. Now, Aaron and his sons are the priests. This is not to the Levites, but to the priests. Later on in verse 21, we read what God has given to the Levites. Now, these people, they worked full time in the tabernacle. The ordinary Israelite did not, and therefore was at liberty to farm or do business or to shepherd or to trade or to do whatever they needed to do to survive. This was not a paid, this full-time ministry prevented them from doing any other paid work. They were paid for their full-time ministry, and that payment is described in verses 8 through 20, the priest's payment, and then verses 21 through 24, and even, 21 through 24 is what the Levites would be paid. Essentially, what we read in 8 through 20 is that all the offerings, all the meat and the grain that is offered, belongs to the priests. They get to eat it. Now, I'm not sure how so few priests in this early stage could eat all the offerings. I presume that some of the offering just couldn't be eaten. Even if there were many, many priests, when you figure there's whole bulls and rams being offered every day. We have one cow in our freezer that we think will serve our family all year long, we hope. And I don't know how a priest could eat a whole bull every day, even if he had several children. It does not tell us exactly what was done with the extra meat. In all likelihood, it was destroyed because the sacrificial meat was holy and no one was allowed to accept the priest. Presumably, they ate as much as they needed for their families, and then the rest was probably either burned up, left to rot, or something. But the point here is, it goes through a list, really, of the things, most of which are things we've been encountered earlier in the law. Mostly, it's sacrifices, the grain offering, everything, of course, except the whole burnt offering. The whole burnt offering, there's nothing left. They'd burn the whole animal. But generally speaking, most of the offerings, there was stuff left over of the animal that was not burned on the altar. They burned the fat and a few other items, and the rest would belong to the priest to eat. We are told down in verse 12, all the best of the oil, all the best of the new wine and the grain, the first fruits, not just the animals that were sacrificed, but the agricultural products as well. I have given them to you, he says. In verse 14, he says, every devoted thing in Israel is yours. And that would mean if people take a vow to devote something to God, this would be a voluntary vow, which they're not required to make, but because of some thankfulness for some special provision from God or some special deal where they want, maybe even, they just want to offer to God something because they're so well off and they feel so grateful. These devoted items usually would be food items, usually animals, would be also the priests for their livelihood. And in verse 15, everything that opens the womb, that would be, of course, of animals, the clean animals, would be offered as sacrifices. Every firstborn lamb, every firstborn goat, every firstborn cow was, when you realize you got millions of people raising livestock, there's going to be a ton of firstborns coming, and they all belong to priests to eat. And so there's a lot there that they have given to them. It goes on and talks about how if it's an unclean animal, at the end of verse 15 says you have to redeem those, and verse 16 says how to do so. It says, those redeemed of the devoted things shall redeem when 1 month old according to the valuation for 5 shekels of silver. Apparently, if a firstborn donkey, a firstborn horse or camel, which are not clean animals and cannot be sacrificed, they still belong to the priest, but the priest redeems them with 5 shekels or whatever. But I'm not sure exactly where that is paid. Usually what is redeemed by the children of Israel, I imagine what goes on there, perhaps the Israelite himself, rather than offering it to the priest, gives the priest 5 shekels of silver. It's not really clarified, But that would be where the priest would get some spending money, some actual cash, and not just livestock for his income. And it goes on to describe basically how they can have all that stuff. He says in verse 20, "Then the Lord said to Aaron, 'You shall have no inheritance in the land, nor shall you have any portion among them. I am your portion and your inheritance among the children of Israel.'" At a later date, when Joshua and the children of Israel conquered the land of Canaan, it was distributed by lot to the 12 tribes. But the tribe of Levi did not receive a portion of land. They received cities to live in. They had to live somewhere. They couldn't all live in the same spot because there were tens of thousands of them. And there were 48 what we call Levitical cities that were designated for them, and they were within the boundaries of all the other tribes' territory. So they were like salt of the earth, you know, scattered among the people to whom they are to be a witness, just as the church is in the world. But they were not given a separate piece of land. Those who were God's priests were not allowed to be cloistered off in some monastery off by themselves. They had to intermix with the society to whom they ministered. And God himself was their portion. They were not losing out on anything by not having land given them. They had God, a special privilege of being chosen by God to be his ministers. Now, verses 21 through 24 essentially tells us that the Levites, which was the larger tribe that did not was not restricted to just the priests, they were started by the tithes of the people. "Behold, I have given the children of Levi all the tithes in Israel as an inheritance in return for the work that they perform." So it was their wage. Now, tithing means, of course, giving 10%. There were, in addition to the tribe of Levi, 11 tribes, although some of them were very small. The tribe of Benjamin was extremely small, especially at a later date, and some of the others were fairly small. But basically, if you take the 10% of the income of 11 people and give it to one person, a Levite, then that Levite will have an income that is about average, just a little above average, because he'll have 1/10 times 11. He'll have 11/10 of what would be the average income. So the Levites would have an income just slightly higher than the average income. It'd be not so much higher as to set him apart in that style. He didn't have any land or anything like that, so he was compensated a little more. The fact is, however, even several of the other tribes combined might be less than the size of one tribe. And so there's no guarantees they'd really have a standard living above others. But essentially, the tenth was a figure that was chosen because of the relative number of Levites that had to be supported. And therefore, the tithe made sense in the sense that it was a good percentage to give the Levites the support that's about middle class, about average. These days, we often hear that Christians ought to pay their tithes to the local church that they attend. This is a very common belief taught in churches. It is not taught in the New Testament that you have to pay tithes. It is not taught in the New Testament that if you do give tithes, you have to give them to local church. Now, there's nothing that forbids it as far as that goes. And if you belong to a church that requires it, then I suggest you do what's required by them. You don't have to join a church if you don't want to keep their policies. But if you join them, I suppose you should in good faith do what they request, or at least what that you agree to do when you join. But as far as the Bible is concerned, giving 1/10 to any one person is nowhere required in the New Testament. The tenth was the Lord's in the Old Testament. 100% is the Lord's in the New Testament. You may, in fact, be required by God to give more than 1/10 to your local church, or maybe less than that to your local church and more than that to someone else. I don't know. It's up to God. You're a steward of everything. Whereas in those days, there was no stewardship concept of money. 10% belonged to the Lord off the top, and you just give it to the priest. There was no decision-making as to how to... Although, of course, one was encouraged to help the poor in addition to their tithes. There was no specific requirement of percentages or anything like that beyond the tenth. Anyway, the Levites lived on the tithes. And then verses 25 and following tell how that the tithe of the Levites, that is 1/10 of their income, which would, of course, be 1/100 of the nation's income, went to the priests. So, and by the way, priests at this point were only four men and their families. In a nation of millions, there were four priests, and they got 1% of the national income. So the priests would be pretty wealthy in this case, until their numbers increased to be a larger percentage. of the nation, and that did, by the way, in the days of Jesus, for example, the number of Israelites was probably not much larger in the world than it was in the days of Moses. There were probably about 3 million here, and it is estimated in the Roman Empire there are about 3 million Jews scattered throughout the world. The reason there are any more is because their numbers have been so frequently decimated in wars and things like that. But in the days of Jesus, there were hundreds, maybe thousands of priests. And for that reason, of course, for them to get 1% of the national income was not so much a big take for them. You know, I mean, they didn't get quite as much. In the early days, when there were not many priests and a lot of Jews, that was a pretty big chunk of money for them. Later on, it probably evened out to at least not quite so much per priest. Well, we're not going to read these verses. I've told you precisely what they say. The Levites received a tithe, that is a tenth of the national income, and they would give a tenth of their income, which would be a hundredth of the national income, to the priests. Now, in chapter 19, laws of purification related to the red heifer. The red heifer, I don't know how rare red heifers are, but we are told by people who think it's important for the Jews to reestablish their sacrificial system that the Jews are currently breeding red heifers somewhere in Europe, I think it is, so that they can restore, when they build the temple again, they can restore this particular ritual of cleansing of the red heifer. Basically, they were to take a red cow and burn it to ashes and put the ashes in water, and this water would be the water used for anointing. People had come to the end of their ceremonial cleansing. Let me just summarize this. There were many things that would make a person unclean in the Jewish law. The one that is mainly repeated again and again in chapter 9 is the contact with a dead body. If a person touches a dead body, they're unclean for a week. There were other ways of becoming unclean, which would make you unclean only until sundown. There were different degrees of defilement. Generally speaking, it would be either till sundown or for a week. Those are the two various increments of uncleanness. And at the end of the period of uncleanness that the law prescribed, the person would wash himself and wash his clothes, and he'd be sprinkled with this water from the red heifer. And that is what this ritual is about. I will read some of it. Now the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "This is the ordinance of the law which the Lord has commanded, saying, speak to the children of Israel, that they bring you a red heifer without blemish, on which there is no defect, and on which a yoke has never come." It's never been used for work. In other words, you don't get your animal up and then offer it to the Lord after you've gotten all you can get out of it. You give your animal while it's fresh, where you've never gained anything from its labor, so that this particular makes it clear that you will not say, okay, I'm going to give this to the Lord, but first I'm going to get a few years' labor out of it, and then we'll give it to the Lord. So that you're giving to the Lord that which you've already taken your share of value out of it for yourself. "You should give it to Eleazar the priest, and he may guide the camp, and it shall be slaughtered before him. Eleazar the priest shall take some of its blood with his finger and sprinkle some of its blood 7 times directly in front of the tabernacle of meeting. Then the heifer shall be burned in his sight, its hide, its flesh, its blood, its offal." That offal is its dung, of course. It would be its intestines at the time of its slaughter. "Shall be burned." Now, most of the time, those things, when an animal is sacrificed, usually the hide, the offal, and some other stuff, would be taken outside the camp. Or certain parts would not be burned. But in this case, they did. Burn it, everything. "The priest shall take the cedar wood and hyssop and scarlet and cast them into the midst of the fire, burning the heifer." It'd be very nice to be able to tell you exactly what the symbolism of that act is. I'm not sure what is gained by throwing cedar and hyssop into the fire and watching it burn up. There are some who would speculate, but I, as far as I'm concerned, that's all it would be is speculation. If any insights about the symbolism of the cedar, the hyssop, and the scarlet. By the way, those who do speculate generally try to find some reference to Christ there. The scarlet maybe representing the blood of Jesus or something, but it's strictly guesswork. as far as I know, I don't know if anyone has received a divine revelation about that. "The heifer shall be burned in his sight, its hide, its flesh. The priest shall take..." Oh, I already read that. Verse 7. "Then the priest shall wash his clothes and shall bathe in water, and afterward he shall come into the camp, and the priest shall be unclean till evening. And the one who burns it shall wash his clothes in water, bathe himself in water, and shall be unclean until evening also. Then a man who is clean shall gather up the ashes of the heifer and store them outside the camp in a clean place. These ashes would later be used to mix with water for the purpose of making holy water for sprinkling. And they shall be kept for the congregation, children of Israel, for the water of purification. It is for purifying from sin. And the one who gathers the ashes of the heifer shall wash his clothes and be unclean until evening, and they shall, and it shall be a statute forever to the children of Israel and to the stranger who sojourns among them. He who touches the dead body of anyone shall be unclean for 7 days. He shall purify himself with water on the third day and on the seventh day, and then he will be clean. Now, the third day and the seventh day, this is repeated elsewhere in the chapter as well. The seventh day is the end of the period of uncleanness. Why the third day as well? I don't know. I don't know. There's never any explanation. Why sprinkle in the third day and the seventh day? It is possible, and I would have to admit this is strictly speculation, but if all of this is a picture of Christ, then it is possible that the third day reminds us of the resurrection of Christ, where he was delivered for our offenses and raised up again for our justification. It says in chapter whatever it is. I think it's at the end of chapter 4 of Romans, says that. Jesus, when he rose from the dead, of course, went into heaven and acquired our cleansing by sprinkling his own blood, so to speak, on the mercy seat. And we receive cleansing as the direct result of his resurrection from the dead, and perhaps being sprinkled with his water on the third day was a foreshadowing. Of course, the Jews wouldn't know this, but and even we don't know for sure if this is it. But it could be that that's what was in God's mind. And then the seventh day, seven being the number of completeness, would simply represent the end of time altogether. The period of uncleanness being the period living in this defiling world. And we are partially cleansed, in fact, very, very significantly cleansed by the blood of Jesus as a result of his death and resurrection on the third day. But we will be completely cleansed from all defilement of the world when we are raised in his likeness at the end of time. And it may be that there's something of this hinted at in the symbolism here, but I certainly can't. I would not wish to be dogmatic about that point at all. Verse 13 says, whoever touches the body of anyone who has died and does not purify himself defiles the tabernacle of the Lord. So he can't go to the tabernacle during the time of his defilement, because the tabernacle itself would be defiled. Verse 14, this is the law when a man dies in a tent. All who come into the tent and all who are in it shall be unclean 7 days. And every open vessel which has no cover fastened on it is also unclean. Perhaps showing concern about germs and things like that, which, of course, they didn't know anything about back then, but God would. Down to verse 17. For an unclean person, they shall take some of the ashes of the heifer, burnt for purification from sin, and running water shall be put on them in a vessel. A clean person shall take hyssop, which is a kind of a brush, sort of a branch, weed, and dip it in water and sprinkle it on the tent, a little bit like a paintbrush on a long branch. On all the vessels and all the persons who were there, or on the one who touched a bone or the slain or the dead or a grave. Anyone who's touched anything related to death has to be sprinkled with this water. The clean person shall sprinkle the unclean on the third day and on the seventh day. Now that the person who is clean sprinkles the unclean, certainly it's tempting to see that as some kind of a veiled reference to Jesus, who is clean, sprinkles us who are unclean. There is a statement in 1 Peter, which probably is not intended to necessarily recall this, but it sounds so similar, I bring it to your attention. It's in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 18. It says in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 18, for Christ also suffered once for sins, for the unjust. He's the clean. We're the unclean. The just for the unjust. The clean person sprinkles the unclean. And in 1 Peter 1, 2, 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 2 says that we are elect according to the foreknowledge of God the Father and sanctification of the Spirit for obedience and sprinkling of the blood of Jesus Christ. So we've been sprinkled, so to speak, figuratively speaking. We haven't really been sprinkled. I mean, in the sense of real liquid being put on our bodies, but our hearts, our conscience has, as it were, experienced the cleansing, the sprinkling of the blood of Jesus Christ. He was the just doing it for the unjust. This ceremony of sprinkling the red heifer water in verse 19 is it's done by a clean person for the benefit of the unclean. By the way, the fact that the heifer is red may very well be significant, red being a symbol of blood. And while the water itself made with these ashes would not be red like blood, because ashes are black, not red, no matter what color the cow was before it was burned, it turns black when you burn it. But the fact that the cow was originally red may be significant. I mean, there are other colors of heifer, and it's specified it has to be a red one. And so the red color may be significant. It may be that with the ashes of the red heifer offered up to the Lord, mixed with water, we've got a liquid that symbolizes the blood of Jesus. Okay, we're going to look down here at verse 21. It shall be a perpetual statute for them. He who sprinkles the water of purification shall wash his clothes. He who touches the water of purification shall be unclean till evening. Whatever the unclean person touches shall be unclean, and the person who touches it shall be unclean until evening. It's interesting under the law of Moses that uncleanness could be transferred by touch, but not uncleanness. Uncleanness could not be transferred by physical contact. Cleanness could not be transferred by physical contact. There's an illustration of this, I believe. I'm working from memory here, and I think it's in Haggai. I wonder if it is. That'd be third book from the end. No, it isn't. Let me see. No, I think it's Zechariah. It's one of those two guys. Let me see here. Well, I better not. Let me see here. No, maybe I'm wrong here. There's a place in the prophets where it is illustrated. I won't go into detail now because I'm concerned about our time. I thought it was in Haggai or Zechariah, but it must be elsewhere. Where one of the prophets talks about this difference, that one can be defiled by touch from a defiled person, but one cannot be made clean by contact with something clean. That was the case under the law. Uncleanness transferred by contact, but cleanness did not. And that is, I think, a very good picture of the way sin is, that if you're in contact with sin, and that is an unregenerate person in contact with sin, or with sinners, will be defiled in their presence. The Bible says the companion of fools suffers harm, and your companionship and your exposure to an environment of sin in your natural state will incline you towards sin. But it is not necessarily the case that exposure to good people will make you good. And yet Jesus came and brought something that was the exact reverse of what conditions prevailed in the time of the law, because Jesus could touch an unclean person, a leper, for example, and they would become clean. He did not. The uncleanness of the leper did not transfer to him. His cleanness transferred to the leper, which is a total reverse flow, of what was in the law. And of course, what that points out is that Jesus brought a whole new life dynamic, a whole new spiritual dynamic, that made his holiness, his goodness, his cleanness transferable by contact with him. We are made clean. He is not made unclean. And that is simply because the law operated in an environment of natural fallen man without the resurrection power of Christ in the picture. But in the resurrection of Christ, there was a reversal of the curse, as it were, of many of the effects of it, so that whatever the gospel comes to, whatever Jesus touches, is affected cleanness rather than the way that things naturally go apart from that dynamic. And so this law in verse 22 of Numbers 19, whatever the unclean person touches shall be unclean, is pretty much a standard, not only of the ceremonial law, it is also a standard experience in moral contact with human beings, unless the power of God is active in a person's life. That prevents defilement with contact with the unclean. Jesus could eat with tax collectors and sinners. He'd become one of them. People, though they're not walking in the Spirit, contact with those people does not enhance their spirituality. Or even keep them pure. Now, in chapter 20, we have, between 19 and 20, we have the probable gap of about 37 years or so. And we are now in the first month, according to verse 1, of the year. And it is evident from the material that is here and from the unbroken flow to the end of the book that this is the last year. This is the year where they begin to make their approach to Canaan to conquer it. They don't actually go in and conquer it, but they make some initial conquests outside the land. They're coming in and making their approach. Moses, of course, died before they actually got in. And chapter 20 tells us why he did. We read of several sad things in chapter 20. Perhaps chapter 20 may be one of the saddest chapters in the whole Pentateuch. We have the death of Miriam. We had the death of Miriam earlier, didn't we? We have the death of Aaron here. We also have Moses' sin. Where was Miriam's death? I thought it was here. Oh, yeah, it is there. It is, verse 1, right, okay. There's just no fanfare made of it. I was glancing down about verse 3 and thought, well, she's not there. I thought it was a little. Thought they took a little longer to tell of it. Yeah, Miriam dies at the beginning, Aaron dies at the end, and Moses does something for which it is announced to him that he will die before he goes into the land of Canaan. So the three members of Moses' family all have bad things happen to them in this chapter. So then the children of Israel came, the whole congregation. Then the children of Israel, the whole congregation, came into the wilderness of Zin in the first month, and the people stayed in Kadesh, and Miriam died there and was buried there. Now, they were in Kadesh last we heard of them, except they turned back to the wilderness. Now, after wandering around for 37 years, they come back to Kadesh. This is the place they had been, where they had sent the spies in and had been turned back in their wandering because of their disobedience before. Now, they're back in that spot, and Miriam dies. We don't know what she dies of, but it very well might have been of old age. She was older than Moses, and he was 120. She was his older sister. Actually, Aaron was older than Moses, too. So at this point, Moses was 120, Aaron was 123, Miriam was older still. So it doesn't require that there be some special plague from God or some special accident to describe that she died. No explanation is needed. She's probably 130 years old, and that was old again. Now, there was no water for the congregation, so they gathered together against Moses and Aaron. And the people contended with Moses and spoke, saying, "If only we had died when our brethren died before the Lord. Why have you brought up the congregation of the Lord into this wilderness that we and our animals should die here? And why have you made us come out of Egypt to bring us to this evil place? It is not a place of grain or figs or vines or pomegranates, nor is there any water to drink." Now, these people, this is the next generation now. I mean, these are the ones who were under 20 when they were at Kadesh Barnea before, and now they're, you know, closer to 60. And they're grumbling just like their parents' generation had. Apparently, the impression is given there never was a cessation. As the younger generation came up, they just learned the grumbling ways from their older generation. And the older generation was at this time almost entirely died off. There were very few left. And the ones that were left died that year. So we have here, essentially, the sins of the parents manifesting in the next generation. So Moses and Aaron went from the presence of the assembly to the door of the tabernacle of meeting. So here they're being attacked, they're being accused, they're being wrongly complained against. And instead of defending themselves, they leave the presence of their accusers and go to the presence of God. And there they fell on their faces, which, of course, we've seen is a regular posture that Moses spent a lot of time in. And the glory of the Lord appeared to them. And the Lord said to Moses, spoke to Moses, saying, "Take the rod, you and your brother Aaron, gather the assembly together, speak to the rock before their eyes, and it will yield its water. Thus you shall bring water for them out of the rock, and give drink to the congregation of their animals." So Moses took the rod from before the Lord, and And Moses and Aaron gathered the congregation together before the rock, and he said to them, "Hear now, you rebels, must we bring water for you out of this rock?" Then Moses lifted his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod, and water came out abundantly, and the congregation and their animals drank. Which ended that crisis, at least from the viewpoint of the people and Moses, but there was a new crisis now. The Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, said, "Because you did not believe me to hallow me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this congregation into the land which I have given them." This was the water of Meribah, which means contention, because the children of Israel contended with the Lord, and he was hallowed among them. Now, this is something that Moses complained about later on to the Lord several times. After God said, "You're not going to take the children of Israel into the land of Canaan," he frequently tried to get God to change his mind. And even when he realized that God wasn't going to change his mind, in Deuteronomy, he frequently refers back to this as he's preaching to the children. He says, because of you, God, you know, I was angry and God didn't let me go into the land. This was a big disappointment to Moses. You can imagine, he's led these people, he's put up with their bad ways for 40 years in the wilderness. He's handled accusation and rebellion against him quite faithfully. And now, the thing he's been looking forward to all this time, going into the land of Canaan, I mean, the 40th year isn't there. He was anticipating this for years. Now he's getting closer, only two more years, only one more year, only a few more months, no doubt. And now he's not even going to go in. And it must have been, it's obvious from his later reactions, his asking God to change his mind and so forth at later date, that this was a real blow to Moses. So, of course, the question arises, why did God do that? Why is God so upset about Moses here? What did Moses really do wrong? Well, there's actually a lot of theories about what it was that Moses did that was really wrong. The obvious thing is he didn't do exactly what God said. God said, speak to the rock, and it'll give its water. Now, what Moses did was different from what God said in several ways. One is he didn't speak to the rock, he spoke to the people. So he didn't speak to the rock. That's what God said to do. Secondly, he smote the rock rather than speak to it. And that, too, was not what God said to do. Some people feel that, in addition to that, God was angry at Moses because Moses expressed wrath. He definitely had a heated spirit when he says, here now you... And he was in a heated spirit when God himself was not. Now, God sometimes did get in a heated spirit toward those people, and sometimes it was Moses that interceded to cool God down when he was about ready to wipe them out. But in this case, God was not at the end of his patience. And Moses appeared to be. Now, why God wasn't, I don't know. Except maybe it's because this was a new generation. God had punished the older generation, and this was sort of a new thing for the younger ones to really complain. I mean, God had, maybe the end of his rope with this older generation, but he's got a lot of rope left with this one, and they haven't worn him out yet. Moses, however, has been enduring this kind of thing constantly for 40 years, and he's at the end of his patience, and he does not reflect God's patience in the city. He's impatient, he's angry, and therefore he does not correctly represent God. God said to Moses, you did not hallow me. That means you didn't regard me as holy. You didn't consider it necessary for people to see me in you, in your behavior. You just did your own thing. And as a Christian leader, or as a leader of God's people, one must be sure that not only are they obedient to God, but that they, even their attitude and everything would be reflective of what God is like, because people look at spiritual leaders to get a reading of what God is like, what God reacts like. And many times, Christian leaders, by their attitudes or behavior, have turned people off to God because of the assumption of the people that this is somehow what happens when someone gets close to God. This guy's this way because must be how God is. Well, that's not always a safe thing to assume, but that is how people do think a lot of times. I mean, Jim Baker or someone like that is a phony for some reason, for some irrational reason. People just say, well, I guess God, this whole God business is phony. And so anyway, whatever it was precisely that Moses did, I mean, which aspect, I mean, there's a number of things that he did not exactly as he should have. God doesn't specify precisely the aspect of Moses' action that bothered him. Now, the typical thing for preachers to say about this, and it may well be true, is that the real problem here was Moses did not understand the whole symbolism of what God was telling him to do. And by not obeying, he destroyed the symbolism. Now, remember when God told him to make the tabernacle, he insisted, do it exactly according to the pattern that I showed you. Don't innovate on this. I showed you exactly the way it should be, precisely the way, and don't deviate in any particular. The writer of Hebrews tells us that the reason that was necessary in chapter 8 of Hebrews, God told Moses not to deviate from the pattern in making the tabernacle because the tabernacle was a pattern of heavenly things. We're supposed to look at the tabernacle and learn spiritual lessons. If the tabernacle is different than God said it should be, then those lessons are altered. Those lessons are obscured by faulty symbolism. And it's possible that Moses speaking to the rock was intended to have a symbolic value. But he didn't do it. He didn't do what he was told, and therefore the symbolism was marred. What's the symbolism? Well, Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, that when the Israelites were wandering in the wilderness, they drank spiritual drink from a rock that followed them. I don't think Paul is necessarily saying the rock rolled around behind them, but this is how he says it. This is 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 4. They all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock which followed them, and that rock was Christ. Now, Paul doesn't say that the physical rock followed them around, but the spiritual rock followed them. Jesus is that spiritual rock who followed them or was with them, traveled with them in the wilderness. He was personified symbolically in a physical rock, which twice, as you may recall, gave them water. The first time was way back in Exodus chapter 17, when they had first come out of Egypt. Before they even came to Sinai, they were out of water. And God actually, on that occasion, told Moses to smite the rock. And he did. He struck it, and water came out. What Moses did on this occasion was not very different than what God had actually told him to do on a previous occasion. The only problem is this time God told him something different. And he did, instead of doing something different, he did the same thing as before. Now, if that rock represents Christ, and the living water that pours out of that rock represents the Holy Spirit, or the spiritual blessings come from Christ, then it's very important that Moses not tamper with symbolism, that Moses not do something contrary to what God says, lest the message, the symbolic message, be destroyed or marred and people not get it. Now, this, I say, is the typical thing for preachers to say, and I have no reason to doubt its validity. I sometimes always wish I could think of something different than what everyone says, but if what they're saying is right, why change it, you know? And that is this, that the rock represents Christ. And back in Exodus chapter 17, the first time God gave water from the rock, it was through them smiting the rock. Moses was told to strike the rock, and he did, and the water came out. The second time, however, he was not told to strike the rock, but only speak to it. And the idea being that Jesus, who was smitten at the cross, smitten for us, so that spiritual blessings might be ours, does not ever have to be smitten again. He sacrificed once and for all. He never went through that ordeal again. He never has to be beaten up again, or whipped at the whipping post, or crucified again. He was smitten once, and that was enough. Henceforth, in order to receive spiritual blessing from Jesus, we need only ask. We only need to speak to him about it. We don't have to smite him every time. He doesn't have to pay the price over and over again every time we have need or refreshment or whatever. Therefore, it was wrong to strike the rock again. And that's why God didn't tell Moses to strike the rock. And he just said, speak to it. But Moses, perhaps not understanding the nature of the symbolism, not taking it seriously enough, not hallowing God enough to realize he better do to the letter what God said to do, he just went out and did essentially his own thing, basically did what God had previously told him to do on the previous occasion, figured that'd be good enough, and didn't realize that the instructions have to be followed to the letter each time. And whatever, if this is the reason that it offended God as badly as it did, or if it is not, it is clear that the leader who has been faithful to God all the way up to this point for 40 years, one act of disobedience in leadership cost him a great deal. It didn't cost him his salvation. He's saved. By the way, he later appeared on Mount Transfiguration with Elijah and talking to Jesus. He's with the people of God today, but he didn't get to, in his earthly life, have the privilege of leading the people into the promised land as he did lead them out of Egypt. And this was a great blow to him, a great disappointment. And it was chastening of the Lord for not being perfect in obedience. Now you might say, well, who then could ever please God fully? I mean, if you're faithful to God until you're 120 years old, and you, in your 120th year you do one thing wrong, and God says, okay, you're disqualified for that, then that makes God seem pretty harsh. And to my mind, it would seem a little rough if this was a matter of Moses' salvation. But it was not. God had to show the children of Israel that leaders have to pay a price. And there's not so many prices out there in the wilderness that he could have Moses pay to be such an evidence of his disapproval for what Moses had done, as to just say, okay, I'm not going to let you lead the people in. And so that was what happened at Meribah. Now, in verses 14 through 21, they came to the edges of the land of Edomites, were descended from Esau, which is, of course, the twin brother of Jacob. Therefore, these nations were related hundreds of years earlier, and many generations earlier.
both nations had come from one father, from Isaac. The Edomites and the Jews both looked to Isaac and before that Abraham as their ancestors. So they were cousin nations, brother nations. But they were never friendly. Just like Esau were not friendly with each other, so the nations that came from them were not friendly with each other. And so Moses sent messengers from Kadesh to the king of Edom, and he says, listen, your brother Israel would like to go through your land. I'll tell you what, we won't go through your fields, your vineyards, we won't touch your food, we won't drink from your wells. We know how precious water is out here in the desert. We will take care of our own provisions. We'll just stay to the king's highway. That is, we'll just stay on the freeway. We won't get off at any off-ramps. And we'll just pass right through because we're going somewhere else. We're not after your land. We're going beyond there. And the shortest way to where we're going is through your land. And the king of Edom sent back messengers, don't you dare come on my land. And Moses sent back messengers and said, listen, we're not going to touch anything of yours. We just want to walk through on the king's highway. And the king of Edom said, you do, and I'll come out and fight you. And so they didn't. They went around. Now, the king's highway in Edom is still there. It's been there for 4,000 years. It's still in use today. It's the king's highway, you know, because it's the king's, it was the smoothest road at the time. The king shouldn't be bothered by bumps in the road. And so whereas most roads were pretty rude, rough affairs, when the king was traveling, they had to make sure they made the road smooth before he came. And they made a highway that was smooth and not many obstacles, and it was usually the straightest course from one place to another. It was paved in the days of the Roman Empire and made into a two-lane road. In Moses' day, it probably was not what we'd call a highway. I mean, it was third world all the way. But that highway is still there, and it's still in use. Anyway, the Edomites would not allow the Jews to go through their land, and for that, they were later punished. The Edomites were later punished for being so inhospitable. Verse 22. Then the children of Israel, the whole congregation, journeyed from Kadesh and came to Mount Hor, around the land of Edom now. And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron in Mount Hor by the border of the land of Edom, saying, Aaron shall be gathered to his people, for he shall not enter the land which I have given to the children of Israel, because you rebelled against my word at the water of Meribah. Apparently Moses and Aaron both were involved in striking that rock. Yes. I don't know if it's still called that to this day. It may be, but it may have another name now. But archaeologists know about its location and know that it's the same highway that runs through that region now. This would be to the south and east of Israel, out in the desert. Okay? Now, essentially what happened in these last verses of chapter 20 is Moses was taken up on the mountain with his son Eleazar. Moses was stripped of his high priestly garments. They were put on his son Eleazar, who already was a priest, but now he became the high priest, the successor of his father. And then, quite simply, without ado, Aaron died there. It says in verse 28, in the middle of that verse, and Aaron died there on top of the mountain. Then Moses and Eleazar came down from the mountain. Now, when all the congregation saw that Aaron was dead, all the house of Israel mourned for Aaron for 30 days. So Aaron and Miriam and Moses were all part of that generation that had come out of Egypt. They had not, as near as we can tell, murmured at Kadesh Barnea. They had not listened to the evil report of the spies. Joshua and Caleb, Moses, Aaron, and Miriam were probably the only survivors at this time of that generation. Now Miriam and Aaron are dead, and Moses will die too before it's over, and only Joshua and Caleb survived to go into the land. We don't know why Miriam was made to die, except that she was just real old. I mean, she was a whole lot older than Moses, and everyone's got to die sometime. She just happened to die before going into the land. Aaron, however, and Moses died before going into the land as direct judgment from God for their misbehavior. Now, chapter 21. This chapter is about some of the initial battles that the Israelites fought before going into Canaan. These battles later became something for Moses to remind them about in Deuteronomy. Because in Deuteronomy, he was going to die. He did die at the end of Deuteronomy. But he was encouraging them to go into Canaan and to smite the Canaanites. Now, remember, their father's generation had refused to do it because of the walled cities and the giants and so forth in the land. And so God gave them some initial victories to show them that, hey, he can handle that. And what in Deuteronomy chapter 3, for example, and 2, Moses, in his sermon there, recalls to the people how they conquered the lands that we now read of in chapter 21. And he points out these people were, some of them were giants, and they had big walled cities, and we conquered them. God gave them into our hands. And the idea was, therefore, don't be afraid to go into the land and do the same to the big cities and the big people there. So these initial conquests were not in the land of Canaan. This was to the east of the Jordan and the south. And really, Israel didn't start these fights. Israel didn't plan to go and fight these people, and I'm not sure God would have required them to, except they were attacked by these people. As they got near the promised land, they had to go through hostile, occupied territory, and the occupants were not happy about them being there and came out to attack them. And God gave them victory, and these victories became the basis for faith that God would give them victory in the future. You know, to have faith in God helps a great deal if you can recall his faithfulness in former crises and challenges. When David had to face Goliath, he remembered that he had previously faced a bear and a lion, which is a hard thing for an unarmed man to do. But he said, God, deliver me out of the mouth of the lion and the paw of the bear, will also deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine. So he figured, well, God's done this amazing thing for me before, and this amazing thing, I guess he'll do the current amazing thing I need him to do for me today too. To remember what God has done in the past inspires faith for the present crisis. And so God gave them some things that they could look back on. As they went into Canaan, they could look back on these victories that we read of in chapter 21 to encourage them that they'd have no problem securing the victories in the land of Canaan as well. When the king of Arad, the Canaanite, who dwelt in the south, heard that Israel was coming on the road to Atharim, then he fought against Israel and took some of them prisoners. So Israel made a vow to the Lord and said, if you will indeed deliver this people into my hand, then I will utterly destroy their cities. And the Lord listened to the voice of Israel and delivered up the Canaanites, and they utterly destroyed them and their cities. So they called the place Hormah. Hormah means utter destruction. Now, this was almost precisely in the same location where 38 years earlier, their fathers had presumptuously gone to battle in chapter 13, you read of it, against Canaanites in that same region and had lost. But now, because the time has come and God is fulfilling his promises, they have victory over the same people in the same region that they had, in a former generation, failed to conquer. Okay. Verse 4. Then they journeyed from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom. And the soul of the people became very discouraged on the way, and the people spoke against God and against Moses. Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in this wilderness? For there is no food and no water, and our soul loathes this worthless bread. Here, God is providing them food for free every day, and they said, oh, it's not, it's worthless, it's boring. So the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, and many of the people of Israel died. Therefore, the people came to Moses and said, we have sinned, we have spoken against the Lord and against you. Pray to the Lord that he take away the serpents from us. So Moses prayed for the people. Then the Lord said to Moses, make a fiery serpent and set it on a pole, and it shall be that everyone who is bitten, when he looks at it, shall live. So Moses made a bronze serpent and put it on a pole so that if a serpent had bitten anyone, when he looked at the bronze serpent, he lived. Now this, by the way, is the last time that we read of the people grumbling. This is apparently this event made a profound impact on them like few of the others had. God had sent plagues among them before and so forth. And by the way, they do sin again, but they don't murmur again, on record anyway. And perhaps they just learned their lesson by these snakes. I mean, out in the desert, living in tents, there's not much protection against snakes if they happen to be numerous. And apparently God sent like a plague of serpents, venomous ones, deadly venomous serpents. And imagine living out in the desert. Every time you go into your tent, there's a snake in your sleeping bag, or you open up the the cupboards and there's a cobra there, and it strikes you and bites. Your children are dying all over the place, and there's just no security from these creatures. They're everywhere, and people are dying everywhere. Well, I think that is so loathsome and terrifying that once it happened, the people could not forget it and thought, well, I don't think I'll take chances by murmuring anymore. I don't want to have another time like that. And so God did show mercy to those who would look at the brazen serpent. Now, the bronze serpent was put up on a pole. The word here in the Hebrew for pole, apparently, from what I've read, is the word for a banner pole. A banner pole is not just an upright beam, but it also has a cross beam from which banners would be hung. When carrying banners out to battle, there'd be the upright pole, which is the handle, and then there'd be a cross beam from which, colored banners and so forth would be hung straight down. And so it was a cross-shaped thing. And Jesus, of course, spoke of the serpent in this case as the type of himself on the cross. In fact, it is the only Old Testament type Jesus identified as a type of his own death. This was in John 3:14. In John 3:14, Jesus said to Nicodemus, "As Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so shall the Son of Man be lifted up, that whosoever believeth in him shall not perish but have everlasting life." So Jesus took this incident that we just read about and compared it with people being saved. The serpent bite being like the effects of sin, the killing effect of sin. The serpent being frequently a symbol of Satan, the tempter. And because of persons having fallen prey to Satan, people dying in sins. But here when the people would look at the bronze serpent on the pole, they would be saved from certain death, from the consequences of sin. And Jesus said that's like himself, will be raised up on a cross. And those who look to him in faith will be healed of that snake bite sin and will not perish and have everlasting life. Now, one thing that's bothered some people is that a serpent would be used as a type of Christ, when in fact it is, as I said, generally speaking, a serpent is a symbol of the devil. If God wished to have a type of Christ in this case, why not stick a lamb up on a pole or something like that, which would be much more in keeping with the typical biblical imagery? Why a snake? And I don't know the answer to that with certainty. There's a couple of things that have crossed my mind over the years as I've thought about that. I don't know if one of them is true or neither. But one possibility is the Bible certainly says that Jesus, when he died on the cross, became sin for us. That all the sins of the world were laid upon him. And that's why he would die. He died under the penalty. He died the punishment of a sinner. Though he had never committed a sin, he took on the guilt of the world's sins so that God had to treat him and judge him as if he was a foul, sinful thing, though he was not ever such. And by his own actions or choices, he was not such. But that was legally what was imputed to him. That he was, it was like he was the devil himself. As he was wicked. Now, Jesus was never personally wicked, but the wickedness of the world was imputed to him, counted on his account. And therefore, at one point when he died, there was someone good died, but someone very wicked, someone very devilish, someone very sinful, because all the whole world was imputed to him. It says in 2 Corinthians 5:21, I think it is, 2 Corinthians 5, I believe it's verse 21, it says, "He who knew no sin became sin for us." And it may picture here the fact that when Jesus died, he died truly as the Son of God, but also, in a sense, as the ultimate sinner. And the snake might represent that. Now, another possibility, and one I'm actually more inclined to, though I don't know if it's true either, is that putting the snake on the pole to represent the crucifixion of Christ might be a symbolic way of saying that even though Jesus died on the cross, it was not he, but the devil who was defeated on the cross. It's as if the devil himself was crucified there. It's as if the devil, not because Jesus is the devil, but because the death of Jesus was the death of the devil, as it were. Because Jesus conquered the devil through his own death. He crushed the serpent's head in the very act of the serpent bruising his heel. That through death, it says in 1 John, excuse me, no, it's in Hebrews 2 and verse 14, I believe it is. It says, through death, Jesus destroyed him who had the power of death, which is the devil. Hebrews 2:14, yeah. Through death, Jesus destroyed him who had the power of death, which is the devil. Also in Colossians chapter 2 and verse 15, it says, having disarmed principalities and powers, meaning demonic forces, he made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them in it, it being the cross in the context. In the cross, Jesus triumphed over and made a public spectacle of the defeated principalities and powers, which include the demonic hosts. Colossians 2:15. So in these places, we read that Jesus' death was not the defeat of Jesus, but the defeat of the devil. To the world's eyes, it was the death and destruction of Jesus. From the spiritual perception, that was not the death so much of righteousness and of goodness and of Jesus. It was not his defeat because he was raised from the dead. It was the defeat of the devil. And that might be something God intended to symbolize by having the snake me on the pole. The defeated serpent on the pole. People would be cured from their snake bite by looking at the emblem of the serpent defeated and hanged on a pole. And it would be the defeat of the serpent through the death of Jesus that would bring about salvation and healing for sin. Now, one other point I want to make about this, and that is that this brazen serpent, this bronze serpent, actually was kept. We don't read of it here, but the Israelites kept this as a, sort of an artifact of their wanderings, and at a much later age, hundreds of years later, people, when the Israelites became idolatrous, they began to burn incense to this bronze serpent as an idol. We read of this in 2 Kings chapter 18. We never read of it again before that, but very late in Israel's history, Judah's actually, in 2 Kings chapter 18, verse 4, it says that Hezekiah, when he was reforming things and getting rid of idolatry in Israel, Hezekiah removed the high places and broke the sacred pillars and cut down the wooden images and broke in pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made. For until those days, the children of Israel had burned incense to it, and he called it Nehushtan, which means a thing of brass, or a thing of bronze. Nehushtan, he called it. Now, they had begun to burn incense to it. When the Jews tended toward idolatry, they made images out of metals and out of wood and so forth. And in times of reform, these had to be destroyed. And apparently, since Moses had, I mean, what could be a more likely object of worship for an idolatrous people that worship images, but one made Moses himself at the hand of God, which had formerly been a form of their deliverance. Yes? That was 2 Kings 18:4. I mean, it shows how God may work through a certain item, but he does not intend for that item to become the focus of worship. God may work through a certain procedure or through an institution or through a certain... But he does not wish for that person or that institution or that agency to eclipse himself. And it's natural enough for us to begin to give credit to and honor and have loyalty to a person or an institution or a thing or a method that God used at one time to do some positive thing and basically for that thing to eclipse God himself. That happened to the Israelites with reference to this bronze serpent. Now, verse 10, Numbers 21:10. Now the children of Israel moved on and camped in Oboth, and they journeyed from Oboth and camped at Ijeabarim, and basically what we read is the Moabites came out against them, and they fought and beat them. Okay. Now there are some poems here given in verses 14 and 15, and verses 17 and 18, and then later on in the same chapter, in verses 27 through 30. This is rather an unusual chapter because it preserves some ancient poetry, apparently written at the time, to commemorate these victories and these provisions of God. It says, I'm sorry, I made a mistake about this. They fought a war in verse 21. This was not a war in verse 10. That's what you get for trying to summarize without reading the actual material again. I read it this morning, but I've read a lot this morning. Let me read these verses. Now the children of Israel moved on and camped at Oboth, and they journeyed to the place I mentioned, which is hard to pronounce, in the wilderness which is east of Moab, toward the sunrise. From there they moved and camped in the valley of Zered. From there they moved and camped to the other side of Arnon, which is in the wilderness that extends from the border of the Amorites, and Arnon is the border of Moab. They did have a conflict with the Moabites, but not quite this early in the chapter. Between Moab and the Amorites. Therefore it is said in the book of the wars of the Lord, Waheb in Sufa, the brooks of Arnon, and the slope of the brooks that reaches to the dwellings of Ar, and lies on the border of Moab. Now this must have been, you know, like a poem that was written by some chronicler of their travels, descriptive of this place where they encamped. But it's not really clear what the great spiritual significance was. It's possible that I'm not sure where the poem is quoted at this point. I won't worry about it now. It takes too long. In verse 16 it says, from there they went to Beer, which literally means well in Hebrew, which is the well where the Lord said to Moses, gather the people together and I will give them water. And Israel sang this song. They wrote a song about this because they had so little water. They found a well of water that was drinkable as something to sing about. So they composed a song. Spring up, O well, all of you sing to it. The well the leaders sank, probably means they dug it. The leaders had to maybe dig out some silt at the bottom of the well to make it drinkable, but they found a well anyway. Dug by the nation's nobles, by the lawgiver, which probably is Moses, with their staves. Hard to know exactly what this is saying about that well. I don't consider it significant for us to dwell on. And from the wilderness they went to Matanah, from Matanah to Nahaliel, and from Nahaliel to Bamoth, and from Bamoth in the valley that is in the country of Moab to the top of Pisgah, which looks down on the wasteland. Now, they have their first battle here, and they have another one before the end of the chapter. They fight with Sihon, who is the king of the Amorites, and then they fight with a guy named Og, who is the king of Bashan. These are to the east of the Jordan. Now, the Jordan is the eastern boundary of Israel, so they were outside the country of Israel, outside of Canaan. But, as I said, approaching, and they actually defeated these kings and took their territory. This land later was given to some of the tribes who wished to settle there because it was good pasture land. And they had a lot of flocks. The tribe of Reuben, the half-tribe of Manasseh and Gad all had a lot of flocks, and they actually got special permission from God through Moses to settle this land, but not until they had first gone in with the other tribes to conquer the land of Canaan. But this is where this tells us of when they first acquired this land that became the inheritance for 2.5 of the tribes. Then Israel sent messengers to Sihon, the king of the Amorites, saying, "Let me pass through your land. We will not turn into the fields or vineyards." Same offer they made to the Edomites. The Edomites had said no and had threatened to come out and fight them, so they just peaceably turned around. Now they made the same offer to the Amorites. "We'd like to pass through your land. We don't want to hurt you. We don't want to eat your food. We don't want to drink your wells. We'll stay on the king's highway. We'll mind our own business." However, Sihon sent his armies out to fight them. Rather than answering yes or no, he just came out to make a war. It says in verse 23, Sihon would not allow Israel to pass through his territory. So Sihon gathered all his people together and went out against Israel in the wilderness and came to Jahaz and fought against Israel. Then Israel defeated him with the edge of the sword and took possession of his land from Arnon to the Jabbok, as far as the people of Ammon, for the border of the people of Ammon was fortified. So Israel took all these cities, and Israel dwelt in all the cities of the Amorites in Heshbon and all its villages. For Heshbon was the city of Sihon, king of the Amorites, who had fought against the former king of Moab and taken all the land from his hand as far as Arnon. So this king who died wasn't, he'd fought and he'd conquered the land in his own time from a previous king. So he wasn't like, he didn't have hereditary rights to the land from ancient times through his ancestors. He had come in earlier in his life and conquered it from a previous king. So he just held it for a while and lost it. Therefore, the Israelites got it. "Therefore, those who speak in Proverbs say," and we have another poem here, "Come to Heshbon, let it be built. Let the city of Sihon be repaired. For fire went out from Heshbon, a flame from the city of Sihon. It consumed Ar of Moab, lords of the heights of Arnon. Woe to you, Moab. It perished, O people of Chemosh." Chemosh was the god worshipped by the Moabites. "He has given his sons as fugitives and his daughters into captivity to Sihon, king of the Amorites." Now, this poem apparently is that was made up not commemorating the Israelite victory over Sihon, but Sihon's earlier victory over the previous king when he conquered the region. This is an old poem that the people of Ammon of the Amorites had sung about their victory over the previous king. It says, "But we have shot at them. Heshbon has perished as far as Dibon, and we laid waste as far as Nophah, which reaches Medeba." Probably we will not set this to music and sing on Friday nights, but it doesn't have that much in it of spiritual edification. "Thus Israel dwelt in the land of the Amorites. Then Moses sent to spy out Jazer, and he took its villages and drove out the Amorites who were there." So they conquered the land of Sihon. Now not to be confused with Zion. Zion was a mountain in Israel. Sihon was this king that they beat. Now there's another king they beat similarly. It says, "They turned and went up by the way to Bashan. So Og, the king of Bashan, went out against them, he and all his people, to the battle at Edrei." Now this Og was a giant. We aren't told that here, but we're told that in Deuteronomy chapter 3, when Moses is recalling this in one of his sermons, in chapter 3 of Deuteronomy, and verse 11, talking about this same Og and this same battle. Moses reminded them, says, for only Og, king of Bashan, remained of the remnant of the giants. Here the word giants in the Hebrew is not Nephilim, it's Rephaim. Nephilim, as I said, is used only twice in the Bible in all Hebrew literature. Here, another Hebrew word is used for giants, but clearly it is describing a giant because it says, indeed, his bedstead was an iron bedstead, pretty heavy guy. I didn't want to break his bed when he laid on it. It is not, is it not in Reba, the people, the city of the people of Ammon? In other words, they have it as sort of a relic, his bed. They've kept it. Now, here's the size of his bed, give you an idea how big he was. 9 cubits was its length, and 4 cubits its width, according to the standard cubit. Well, that's 13.5 feet long. That's for his height. To accommodate his height, he had a bed 13.5 feet long and 6 feet wide. We have beds today that are 6 feet wide, but not very many. They're 13.5 feet long. Apparently, he slept alone. That's what we'd call a king-sized bed. And he was the king of the giants. Okay, now back to Numbers. We have this man mentioned, but not with reference to his size. And he came out with his armies to battle at Edrei. By the way, archaeologists have uncovered Edrei. It's mostly under sand now, but they've uncovered it and found it was an immense city. And apparently it was a tremendous accomplishment, the conquest of it. But God gave it into the hands of the Israelites. It says, the Lord said to Moses, do not fear him, for I have delivered him into your hand. This is verse 34. With all his people and his land, and you shall do to him as you did to Sihon, the king of the Amorites, who dwelt in Heshbon. So they defeated him, his sons and all his people, until there was no survivor left him, and they took possession of his land. Well, therefore they have two major kingdoms and kings that they've defeated to look back on. And that scared another king whom they were actually not threatening. And he was the Moabite king. And his name is Balak. And we read of that in chapter 22. And this Balak actually is given a lot of space. The whole conflict with Og is given in only 3 verses. But that with Balak is in chapters 22, 23, and 24. 3 chapters. And that is because there's something rather interesting associated with Balak. He was afraid the Israelites might conquer him as they had these other two kings. So he went away to Mesopotamia to a well-known soothsayer down there to persuade him to come and curse the people, because there was a reputation this man had that if he cursed people, they'd be cursed. And if he blessed them, they'd be blessed. This man's name was Balaam. He's one of the most confusing characters in the Bible. Because everything he says, he sounds like he's godly. He always talks like he worships Jehovah. He won't do anything except what Jehovah tells him to do. A person could offer him a household of gold, a house full of gold, and he still wouldn't do anything but what God told him to do. The man speaks as if he's about as committed to God as anyone could be. But there's a great deal of mystery associated with him. One thing is that he's remembered in the scripture as a bad man. Not a good man. We'll talk about why a little later. Secondly, it's not clear how he knew about Jehovah. He lived by the river Euphrates. He apparently was not Jewish. He was not acquainted with the children of Israel until he was asked to pray about or asked to curse them. And he prayed about it and God said, no, you can't curse these people. They're my people. So Balaam apparently was not a Jew. In all likelihood, he was a Babylonian like Abraham had been before. And yet he was acquainted with the God Jehovah. Though very possibly not uniquely, he might have been a Babylonian soothsayer who knew of many gods and honored whichever one seemed to be relevant to his particular clients. It's not clear. One thing is clear, that he was not a prophet of God. He was a diviner. He was a soothsayer. He was a fortune teller kind of a guy, and we find this stated quite plainly. For example, it says in chapter 24, verse 1, now when Balaam saw, 24:1, that it pleased Jehovah to bless Israel, he did not go, as at other times, to seek to use sorcery. And he usually used sorcery. He stopped doing that about chapter 24, verse 1. He was a sorcerer. He was a pagan. He apparently was acquainted with the Jehovah, at least by reputation. Whether he had actually ever been in actual communication with Jehovah prior to this, we don't know. God did speak to him, though, and it's not unheard of for God to speak to occultists through their occult means. Now, God forbids the use of the occult, But that doesn't mean that if people use the occult, he can't get through to them. Anyway, he spoke to Saul through the witch of Endor and the calling up Samuel's ghost. I've known of cases, these are of course anecdotal and you can't base an awful lot on it, but I've known of cases where people were involved in the occult as non-Christians and God came through, broke in on the line and essentially rebuked them. And I remember one guy, a friend of mine, he was in jail and he was involved in the I Ching, which is a Chinese form of divination and casting hexagrams with sticks and stuff. I don't know exactly how it all works, but he was witnessed to while in jail by a Baptist, and he'd mocked the Christians and so forth. But then when he consulted the I Ching, some way or another, he said, confirmed to him that Christianity was true and that he ought to give up the I Ching. I've heard of people who have similar experiences with Ouija boards. Now, the fact that God can speak through these means is in no sense an argument for using these means. God forbids the use of these means. He forbid it. I mean, for Saul to go to the witch of Endor was a violation of what God wanted, and God killed him for it the next day. But he did speak to him through it. And this man, I believe, Balaam, was just a pagan sorcerer, soothsayer. But God, wanting to get through to him and tell him something on this occasion, broke in the line and spoke to him, even though the man very possibly was not that acquainted with God and maybe not accustomed to hearing from God before. Well, that's what this story is about. And essentially it takes up a lot of chapters, 20, 23, and 24. I was actually hoping we might get through these chapters in one sitting, one session, which would make a whole lot of sense since it's a continuous story. But our time is limited. We will not reach that. But we can at least start. In chapter 22 it says, "Then the children of Israel moved and camped in the plains of Moab on the side of the Jordan across from Jericho. Now Balak, the son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites," that would be Sion and Og, "and Moab was exceedingly afraid of the people, because they were many, and Moab was sick with dread because of the children of Israel. So Moab said to the elder Midian, 'Now this company will lick up all that is around us as an ox licks up the grass of the field.' And Balak, the son of Zippor, was the king of the Moabites at that time." Now it says Moab said to the elders of Midian in verse 4. Midian and Moab were different nations. Actually, to them were descended from similar stock. Moab was the person Moab, from whom the Moabites came, was the son of Lot, who is Abraham's nephew, born to one of Lot's daughters, fathered by Lot himself. The Moabites and the Ammonites both came from that source. The Midianites were descended from a man named Midian, of course, who was the son of Abraham by Keturah. So Abraham and Lot were uncle and nephew, and these two nations were related to each other, actually not quite as closely as Edom was to Israel, but they were apparently more friendly with each other than Israel and Edom were. And they figured that, the Israelites have wiped out the Amorites, we better combine forces, Moab and Midian, and try to stop them. Then he sent messengers to Balaam, the son of Beor, at Pethor, which is near the river. Now, when it says the river, it means Euphrates. That's how the Euphrates is generally spoken of in Scripture, is the river. So the Euphrates, it's up in Mesopotamia, up in the region from which Abraham had originally come centuries earlier, "in the land of the sons of his people, to call him, saying, 'Look, a people has come from Egypt. See, they cover the face of the earth and are settling next to me.'" Sort of menacing neighbors. "Therefore, please come at once, curse the people for me, for they are too mighty for me, because perhaps I shall be able to defeat them and drive them out of the land, for I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and whom you curse is cursed.' So the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian," they joined forces together to go pay Balaam service, "departed with the diviner's fee in hand. And they came to Balaam and spoke to him with the words of Balak. And he said to them, 'Lodge here tonight, and I will bring back word to you as Jehovah speaks to me.' So the princes of Moab stayed with Balaam." Now, he's using the word Jehovah here, or for God, which is interesting. He knew Jehovah, or knew of him. And apparently, maybe he even knew that by reputation the Israelites were worshippers of Jehovah. So he thought, I better consult their God and see what he's up to, see what kind of God we're dealing with here. "Then God came to Balaam and said, 'Who are these men with you?' And Balaam said to God, 'Balak, the son of Zippor, king of the Moabites, has sent them to me, saying, "Look, the people come out of Egypt. They cover the face of the earth. Come now, curse them for me. Perhaps I shall be able to overpower them and drive them out. And God said to Balaam, you shall not go with them. You shall not curse the people, for they are blessed. So Balaam up in the morning and said to the princes of Balak, go back to your land, for the Lord has refused to give me permission to go with you. And the princes of Moab rose and went to Balak and said, Balaam refuses to come with us. Then Balak again sent princes more numerous and more honorable than they. And they came to Balaam and said to him, thus says Balak the son of Zippor, please let nothing hinder you from coming to me, for I will certainly honor you greatly, and I will do whatever you say to me. Therefore, please come, curse the people for me. Set your own price, in other words, and we'll pay it. And Balaam answered and said to the servants of Balak, though Balak were to give me a house full of silver and gold, I could not go beyond the word of Jehovah my God. Now, he calls Jehovah his God, which is interesting, though God doesn't apparently see him as one of his people, as becomes clear in the remainder of the story. Perhaps now, at this point, he might actually be claiming him for more fees, too. I mean, though he would offer me a house full of silver and gold, hint, hint, you know, like, name your fee. Well, a house full of silver and gold wouldn't quite be enough, you know. The king is desperate. He'll do anything. He might be playing hard to get. It's hard to say. He sounds very religious and very committed, but he may be just playing the bargaining game. Now, therefore, please, you also stay here tonight that I may know what more the Lord will say to me. And God came to Balaam at night and said to him, if the men come to call you, arise and go with them, but only the word that I speak to you, that you shall do. So Balaam rose in the morning and saddled his donkey and went with the princes of Moab. Then God's anger was aroused because he went. Now this is real strange, and I don't think we have time to do much justice to the rest of the chapter. But why was God angry when he went? God told him, go ahead and go with them. And so he got up and did. God was angry that he went. And, of course, this leads to the very famous story about the donkey that talked to him. But we'll maybe save that till the next time we get to Numbers. But why would God be angry with him on this occasion when he's only doing what God said? We are not told, but I think we must have to assume this. We are told later in the New Testament that Balaam loved the wages of unrighteousness. We are told that in 2 Peter 2:15. In 2 Peter 2:15, it says that Balaam loved the wages of righteousness. And he apparently was in it for the money. Now, he sounded very religious when he said, I can't do it unless God tells me. But he was really in his heart saying, I'm going to keep asking God until he tells me what I want to hear. God had already revealed his will unmistakably. You can't curse these people. They're blessed. Forget it. The answer is no. Balaam comes back and says, God, you know, they're offering me more money this time. And God says, oh, well, then by all means, go. You know, I mean, go ahead, go with them. Just make sure you don't say anything more than I tell you to say. But God had already given him a contrary word. He had no business asking again just because they were making the stakes higher, because they were offering more, because they were offering to honor him at a higher degree. Suddenly he says, well, maybe we can get God to give us a different answer. And sure enough, God did give him a different answer, the one he wanted. But it wasn't the one that really reflected the will of God. And this, the fact that he didn't do what he knew was right, even though he had managed to, as it were, coax God to give him the answer he wanted, it displeased God. He was angry at him that he went. Even though we might assume that Balaam did not intend to say anything more than what God would tell him to say. But hey, what's the point of going? He's going there to curse the people. He's not going to get any fees if he doesn't do that. So obviously, Balaam was still planning to go and curse the people. Or I mean, that's what he was being hired to do. He said, no, I'm sorry, I can't curse these people. But he said, no, I'm going to go. And even though God said, only say what I tell you to say, Balaam must have been still planning to curse the people. Well, by hook or crook, he was going to get his pay. He loved the wages of unrighteousness. He didn't care if he had to do an unrighteous thing to get those wages. As it turned out, as we will read in the rest of the story, which we won't now, he did end up only blessing the people verbally. But he had another thing he thought up where he managed to bring a curse on the people. And this is why he's remembered in the New Testament as a wicked man, but conniver. But we'll have to, unfortunately, break the story at this point, which is a very inopportune time to break. But we have to do so because of the time that has run out. And we'll have to take the rest of the story next time.